From 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Today on the show, news analyst Charlie Sykes puts Paul Ryan's sudden announcement in context.
And then the steps DanceWorks takes to protect secret holders in its new production, Secrets of the Wide Sky.
Some would be completely anonymous written secrets on pieces of paper that we all threw into the mix, and those to this day we've all held true to this idea, don't tell anyone which secret is yours. And don't ask anyone, is this yours?
Why Thornton Wilder's Our Town is still relevant after 80 years and countless productions.
If we're still doing American plays from the 20th century in 500 years, or for the people 1,000 years from now that Thornton Wilder invokes in the first act, I think this will probably be the one that we're still doing. It's about everything that it is to be a human being.
And Wisconsin writer Rebecca Brown draws on two compelling personal stories to inform her new novel. Lake Effect is next. News is first.
This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for joining us. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Bonnie North. The latest in a seemingly endless series of political earthquakes shook the country yesterday when Speaker of the House Paul Ryan of Wisconsin announced he will not seek re-election. There had long been rumors that he would retire in the next year or so, but Ryan's announcement on Wednesday stunned both Republicans and Democrats.
The decision comes during a difficult period for Republican office holders, as Democrats have won special elections and statewide races for seats that had previously been seen as safely in the hands of the GOP. We're joined on the line by news analyst Charlie Sykes to help add some context to the story. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you.
So there had been rumors that Paul Ryan would step down sometime after the November election. What is the potential speeding up of the timeline say to you?
Well, first of all, I had believed those rumors, and I had did not expect he was not going to run for re-election, because this sort of an announcement feels like he's running up the white flag on the House Republican majority. It really complicates the effort of Republicans to hold the House. He was the prolific fundraiser. It's going to feed this narrative of the blue wave in a rather dramatic way, which is why I did not expect that he was going to do it. So, the acceleration of this announcement certainly reflects just look, this is the new political reality. This is Donald Trump's Republican Party. It's not Paul Ryan's Republican Party. And even though he's made many, many compromises and acquiesced in many things and enabled many things, ultimately I'm guessing that it was a very, very frustrating last year and a half for Paul Ryan.
How much does this speak to any potential minefields he saw in his own reelection effort, or is this really just about the national state of the GOP?
I would say more national. I mean, don't underestimate the personal element as well, that that Paul Ryan never wanted to be speaker. He when he talks about the family, usually you can discount politicians when they talk about spending more time with their family. But there is an element of real sincerity there. But I do think that this reflects more the national scene. Including what it's like being the Speaker of the House of Representatives in the era of Donald Trump. I do think that Paul Ryan could have been reelected. I think he would have been reelected. But I think it would have been a tough race. I think it would have been a costly race. And he would have then gone through the summer of Donald Trump's who knows what. Perhaps thinking, do I really want to spend the next, 6-9 months dancing around Donald Trump's decision to fire Bob Mueller or whatever else might actually happen? But it is a rather extraordinary moment when you have somebody of Paul Ryan's stature, his record, and his legacy, deciding to pull the plug in the middle of a very, very tough midterm election cycle.
Well, and even given his complex, if we can use that word, relationship with the president, does Paul Ryan have particular accomplishments he can point to during his tenure?
Yes, he does, but it's going to be mixed. And this is the real paradox. I mean, he's going to talk a lot about obviously, the tax reform bill, which was a big win for him. But on the other hand, one of Paul Ryan's great accomplishments in his career was raising consciousness about the national debt, the need to reform entitlements, and to get the budget under control. before Donald Trump, he succeeded in doing that. But he's now going to be leaving as Speaker, presiding over $1 trillion a year deficit. And that's kind of mind-boggling for somebody who is so closely identified about warning people about the looming debt crisis to actually be leaving as Speaker, having presided over rather dramatic increases in that federal debt.
Paul Ryan has been doing a fairly heavy series of fundraisers and still has several on his schedule. How does this news affect his ability to raise money for the Republican Party?
Well, that's an excellent question. That's one of the reasons why I did not think he was going to make this announcement. He is the most prolific fundraiser for House Republicans, and obviously it's going to damage that significantly. My guess is that's one of the things that will send shockwaves through the congressional party. And I wouldn't be surprised, quite frankly, to see other Republicans also now choose to retire rather than face re-election. But the money is a considerable issue here for Republicans now.
What about the machinations in his decision whether to step down before his term ends, step down from the Speaker's role versus sticking it out?
Well, that may not be up to him anymore. I would not be surprised to see considerable pressure to have a leadership election between now and November. There's nothing that is inevitable about him remaining as Speaker through next January. Let's wait and see. You know, the reaction that I'm getting today from Wisconsin Republicans is that they are completely taken by surprise. They're shocked and stunned by this. And I'm guessing that there's a corollary in Washington where people just haven't quite figured out all the implications of this.
Right. And presumably there are not a lot of advantages for the Republican Party in having a lame duck Speaker over the next 6 months.
No, there's not. But it also becomes intriguing to ask, now that he's not running for re-election, how will a liberated Paul Ryan behave toward President Trump? Will he feel the need to continue to be his wingman in Congress? We've seen a lot of other Republicans who have, once they've announced they're not running for re-election, have felt free to be much more independent and willing to be critical of the president. If that's true with Paul Ryan, either in the speakership or out of the speakership, it's going to be a rather considerable political development, to put it mildly.
How much does this embolden Democrats at this stage, or is this old news by November?
Oh, no, it definitely emboldens Democrats because it feeds into a narrative that becomes self-fulfilling at a certain point. Yes, the only poll that counts is in November, but in terms of candidate recruitment, in terms of money, in terms of mobilization, in terms of voter enthusiasm, this matters a great deal. And here in Wisconsin, it matters a great deal because, of course, you know, we have seen the fact that Democrats and liberals have been far more motivated to turn out, and they have won a series of special elections. And so the question is, you know, is this going to embolden Democrats for the November election here in Wisconsin even more? I would say so. I mean, right now, that Paul Ryan's seat itself has gone from lean Republican. To now a toss-up. This is now a winnable seat for Democrats, and that tells you a little bit about how an announcement like this just changes the political dynamic.
Of course, as we've discovered, a lot can happen in a very short period of time.
Yes.
Charlie Sykes, appreciate the analysis at such short notice. Thank you so much. We'll talk to you again soon.
Thank you.
Charlie Sykes is the author of several books, the latest of which is How the Right Lost Its Mind. He's a regular commentator on MSNBC and an occasional Lake Effect news analyst. You can find much more coverage of Paul Ryan's announcement at WUWM.com.
Next on the program, we talk with DanceWorks artistic director Danny Kepper about DanceWorks' new show, Secrets from the Wide Sky. This is Lake Effect from WUWM. We'll be right back.
Lake Effect continues now on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Among the many things going on in the performing arts this week, one of the productions that's worth knowing about is DanceWorks spring performance, Secrets from the Wide Sky. It is a mix of original choreography, music, and the shared secrets of its performers.
Dani Kepper is DanceWorks artistic director, and she joined me in the studio recently to explain more about the show, which originated with founder Sarah Wilbur's idea of a wide sky performance.
What we mean by that is that either in performance or in inspiration, that we draw inspiration from not only the dancers in the room, but also a wider sky, a wider cross-section of community members. So in this case, we have some middle school and high school students, most notably, that are involved beyond our DanceWorks Performance Company members. So that makes our age range in terms of, like, where are we getting these secrets and stories and inspirations from? Our youngest is about 13, and our oldest is, guess what, it's me. I just turned 45. So it's not the largest age range we've ever worked with, but I think it's a really meaningful one.
Well, you talk about secrets, and that's part of this, is the idea that everyone contributes something, but that it's protected so that in performance you can't point to, oh, that's that person's.
Exactly. That's been the magic. And we started talking right from the beginning, working with the dancers, specifically the company members, first and foremost, to say, okay, it's ultimately up to you how much risk, you know, that you take on when you share a secret. And we had a variety of ways that we had to share secrets. So some would be completely anonymous written secrets on pieces of paper that we all threw into the mix. And those, to this day, we've all held true to this idea. Don't tell anyone which secret is yours. And don't ask anyone, is this yours? And then it's the idea that you draw a piece of paper when you're going to make a dance from it. You draw a piece of paper, and it may not be your own. It could be someone completely different from you with a different life experience. But then it's your job to figure out, how do you empathize with that secret? What do you know from your life experience that makes you understand that secret? And some of them are silly and funny, and some of them are really heartbreaking. but working in that way, it's really a concert about empathy. But then another way that we've shared secrets is I ask the dancers, if you want to, send me audio of you in your room, in your car, wherever you are. And two of those audio secrets have become part of the show. And so that's, like you said, that's one of the few times that you know this is this person's secret, that's their voice, and they've authorized the release of this secret. And in that case, it's a little bit about, you know, the secrets we keep in our mind about our self-perception, you know, the bad talk that you do to yourself sometimes, you know, what you keep in your head. And then there were audio secrets that are not shared, that I know who they are, but it's more for inspiration of dance making, but not for any reveal. So there's all kinds of layers. And I feel so honored. Some of the things that the dancers have sent to me is like, oh, man.
Yeah, it's hard sometimes to be a witness to things. Mm-hmm. And then sometimes it's also really lovely because it's just a joyful thing.
Yes. Yeah, to know the secrets of things that people are excited about and think about. And I was thinking right from the beginning, how will I honor this in a way that's artistic and secretive, you know, so not to reveal too much? So right from the beginning, I had the idea to work with my friend, Jennifer Kohnhorst, who is a really talented author of poetry, and also is a really good, she's won the Moth Storytelling Contest, I think twice, in Minneapolis. And the funny thing is, we've been friends since we were 4 years old. So we have a huge life history together. And anyway, she knows the ins and outs of me, and I know the ins and outs of her. And so I thought, I asked the dancers, can I send the recordings? Like, she doesn't know you guys, and she won't know whose story is whose, even when she comes to see the show. And so they all authorized me to send the recordings to her. So her and I are the only ones that have heard everything, right? And then she wrote poems that abstract all of the details of the secrets enough so that they can be shared in a way and also embodied by all of the dancers. So that's been a really important layer. Like, how can we find truth in sharing secrets without risking people's anonymity?
Right. You need to be protective in a way, but yet be free to be fully creative at the same time. That's a difficult balancing act to do. Well, and then you're also combining movement with music and with spoken word. And so you have a lot of different ways into that, I would think. And, you know, I love movement to spoken word because it's not something we see as much of as I think we should.
It's true, and it's difficult to do. That's probably why you don't see it all that often. I know I have a friend that's an actor that, you know, she's pretty critical of, as she should be, you know, like, are you able to embody the words? Embody the words and the movement at the same time, and it's really important to do that. So that's what we're really working towards. Almost all of the dancers are speaking quite a bit. Some just a little bit, not because they aren't able to, but just the way, you know, the way it all landed. But so that's been a big task for all of us, including the middle school and high school students.
So you're memorizing things in addition to mm-hmm. memorizing movement.
Yes. And figuring out how to have meaning be felt and seen and all of that is difficult. But anyway, I think we're doing a good job. I think it's a little bit of dance concert / physical theater, I would say.
It is something that I think dance has incorporated more in the last few decades, that kind of experimentation and the idea that there are lots of ways to express yourself through movement.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, do you find that true in all the time you've been dancing and choreographing? Has that become more acceptable as a way of approaching the work?
Yeah, I think the very first dance that I choreographed when I was a college student was a piece about my grandmother called Mrs. Schultz. And it was a solo that I spoke and moved at the same time almost the whole time. And I remember at the time getting a lot of questions, you know, how are you balancing this? And now really it's not something that I would be questioned about so much, but I think it's still the question of how to do it well, you know? So I think that's a pretty important thing. One thing I should say that has been such a huge, as you already mentioned, that we have music in this concert. So we're working with Alan Russell, who is a composer in town and a violinist. He's great, so easy to work with, you know? And he has been so invaluable because he's been in the studio with us. And as we're trying to figure out how long does it say to take that, you know, to say that part of the poem? Okay, Alan, can you extend that 30 seconds? And, you know, so some of that we've done through email, of course, and in other ways. But and me just predetermining how much time I think. But he's been right there to be hands on and change it on the fly, which is a gift because I have done these kinds of concerts in the past. I did Falling from the Wide Sky a while back and Tall Tales from the Wide Sky. And both of those had a lot of language, not poetry. So it wasn't crafted language. So that's I'm really excited about these two new ideas, that the language is still from the Wide Sky, from the people that are, you know, dancing in the concert. But that it's crafted into an art in and of itself, and that the music is completely crafted to work in tandem with the movement and the words. And Alan and I, we started off actually working side by side. So he would just create music that has the sounds of keys jingling, you know, secret doors and things, and the sounds of shushing. But that his original inspirations, of course, now it's all morphed and become, you know, a unified language. But we worked side by side really without sharing too much, working in secret. And now we really are connecting. So
secret kind of plays through all of this. But then eventually things are revealed.
Yes.
In a way that, again, is safe and creative.
Yeah, I hope so. I feel pretty certain, you know, you never know for sure, but I feel 99% certain that all the dancers feel secure, you know, and I've asked them over and over. There was one poem I had to change some details, and Jennifer gave me authorization to do that. I had to change some details so as not to make some family members feel uncomfortable, things like that, and then just change the person that says the words. So mm-hmm. if you change a few details, keep the heart of it the same, but then shift the person that's saying the words out loud, I think it gives enough, you know, anonymity.
Well, and the important thing is the sort of the general human feeling that the words and movement do. It's not about somebody's specific story. It's about the fact that we all have stories.
Yeah.
Were there any stories that you thought to yourself, no, I can't touch this?
Yes. Yes, there was one dancer, and it's, I guess I can't even talk about it here. It's something that he is clear with in a group of friends and among us, but his family isn't clear with this idea, with this secret. So it was like, nope, we can't include that. He's not ready for that yet. But nonetheless, it's like, it's a part of our process that as a group, we all know, you know, we know this thing, we know we're helping protect that person. So that, I think, builds integrity. And also middle school and high school students, I was very careful because, of course, I'm not going to put myself in a position to say, oh, tell me a secret. You know, what if they tell me something? You know, they're too young to put on the spot like that. So, Jennifer helped me troubleshoot, you know, what's an appropriate secret topic area for kids to engage with, but would be really truthful and honest. And she thought of like fortune teller games, you know, that little paper fold up thing that you go 1, 2, pick a number, pick a color. And the games that you play when you're young that are about predicting the future, you know, knowing the secret of the future. And she also thought of that one where you have an apple, you twist it until the stem comes off and you say the alphabet, A, B, C, D. If the apple stem breaks there, then the person you're going to marry is, you know, his name starts with a D. So we played these games with the middle school and high schoolers as in a silly way. And we created a dance out of those that's very fun and playful. But then we sat down with them actually just last week. And it was so great just saying, what do you think about in the, you know, what's going to happen in the future? What do you worry about? And ACT scores. What if I get an A minus instead of an A? You know, these kinds of things. And one girl just said, I can't make any decisions. Like, she's 15 years old and she feels she can't make any decisions. So how is she going to make any decisions? And then in the room with Kim Johnson, who is 44 years old, she's dancing with them for the section. And hers is, you know, how old will I be when I finally retire? You know, so we're like juxtaposing sort of the secrets of what people worry about or think about what's in the future.
It's that kind of thing where you finally, when you get to a certain age, you realize, gosh, everyone's thinking about this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
In some form or another. You think you're so alone when you're a teenager, like nobody's ever thought of it and nobody would understand you.
Exactly.
And why you're thinking about it. And then you discover, oh, wait, like everyone's got a version of this. And in a way, that's such a relief.
That's what I'm hoping. I mean, yeah. I think that's like the thesis statement of the concert. And truth be told, postsecret.com is, I don't know if you've heard of that, but it's...
I've interviewed the guy who created it.
Yeah, yeah. That's cool that he was here. And it was probably 4 years ago I heard his TED Talk. And that really got me thinking. I did some of the research on this secret thing, kind of devising ways to gather secrets with protecting the dancers with a group of UWM students a while back. And Zach Schorsch is one of our dancers now. He also was in, and Maggie Sear. They're two current dancers that were in that UWM piece. So I've been thinking about it a while. Just how does that translate into dance making? And also dance, but all the arts are so much about empathy. You know, you sit in the audience and you watch the dancers or you listen to people singing or whatever it is that they're doing. And to me, whether you connect with something or not is whether or not you empathize with them. You know, do you feel that you can identify yourself in that whole thing? And so many times at Danceworks, we very outright, very evidently are engaging audience members, like come up on stage and do this thing or, you know, something silly like that. But in this way, the audience engagement part to me is really how can we invite them to empathize, you know, with these stories.
Danny Kepper, it is so great to see you. Thanks for stopping by.
Thank you.
Danny Kepper is Artistic Director for Danceworks. The company's production, Secrets from the Wide Sky, runs this weekend and next Thursday through Saturday at Danceworks Studio Theater.
Another quick break now, and then we move south a few blocks to the Milwaukee Rep, where a production of Our Town officially opens tonight. You're listening to Lake Effect from Milwaukee's NPR.
Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. We're about to talk about one of the iconic plays of American theater. And Mitch, don't you just love it?
We are talking about Death of a Salesman, right?
No, not quite, although that's a good guess. We're talking about Our Town. It's the 1938 work by Wisconsin native Thornton Wilder, although he set the show in fictional Grover's Corners, New Hampshire, rather than in his home state.
There have been innumerable productions from grade school to Broadway in the 80 years since it was written. Amazingly, I have missed all of them. The Milwaukee Rep throws its hat into that ring, though, with its current production.
It stars local favorite Laura Gordon as the stage manager, and Gordon and director Brett Hayes Hazelton joined me in the studio to talk more about the show.
It is one of the greatest plays ever written. And if we're still doing American plays from the 20th century in 200, 300, 500 years, or for the people 1,000 years from now that Thornton Wilder invokes in the first act, I think this will probably be the one that we're still doing. It's about everything that it is to be a human being. And I don't think any of the concerns in the play are ever going to change. I don't think it's all going to go away. I mean, a play about how we are incapable of getting out of our own ways to connect more deeply with those around us seems like something that is going to be a human question from now until there are no more humans.
It's like he somehow tapped into that very human thing of, like, we can't be in the moment. It's like we say we want to be, but we somehow can't do it. And he puts that all together on a very simple stage.
He does. And the moment's continually passing us by, right? This notion of presence. And every time you become conscious of not being present, you can't possibly be present to the moment because the moment's behind you.
You've already
passed
it.
So, yeah, it's like this sense of trying to continually catch up to your own life, you know?
And yet it's always still a worthy pursuit to try to,
absolutely,
to try to do it.
Absolutely.
Right?
Well, and I guess that's the brilliance of the play,
right,
is that despite everything, and despite death, and despite all of the things that make up the human condition, it's still very much worth living and trying to do the best you can.
Yeah.
And so, Laura, for you, you're playing the iconic role of
right?
the stage manager.
I know.
And, the words that you get to say.
Oh, it's such a gift. I'm telling you, I've enjoyed learning this part almost more than I think any other part that I've sat down to memorize, you know, because there's some, you know, there's some chunky speeches in here to commit to memory. And it's so, I mean, I'm always pretty persnickety about being word perfect on roles that I learn, but this is, it's so exacting. I can feel when I'm missing a syllable, you know, and when you get all the words in the right order and you get them all lined up, it's, there's so much joy, I find, in stringing these thoughts together. It's a real privilege.
I was going to say, it sounds like it's a piece of music that you have to get all the notes.
Almost, yeah.
Yeah,
yeah, I think so.
You two first started talking about it as director and actor, what were some of the conversations about?
Oh, gosh, everything. I mean, we talked very little about the specifics in the play, I think, initially, and just much more about broader ideas and what we didn't know, and I think spent a fair amount of time talking one another into being comfortable with not knowing.
Absolutely.
Right?
This kind of character is interesting. I was talking to my husband about this, who's an actor as well, and he said, I love playing supernatural characters. I love playing ghosts and Dracula and Satan and all of these people. And it's not that the stage manager is like that, but you can't kind of piece together a backstory, really. I mean, I don't think that that's particularly fruitful to doing this play.
Yeah, the stage manager when he was six.
No,
or she was six.
Doesn't really come into play,
yeah.
You know? And so I've been less concerned about who this character is and more concerned with why they're there in what they're trying to do. And as I get clearer on the why, the who becomes clearer. And so it's like a different way of working.
Do you find that difficult to play, though, if you're trying to play the why?
No, because everything that we do as actors, we want to be clear about what it is that we want and what our objectives are. And so in trying to come at why I'm doing something. And I'm not concerned about who. I mean, at the end of the day, it doesn't matter. And whether this character is, that's the other thing that's so brilliant about the play, is that it could feel like a cosmic being, you know, because there's knowledge of the future. But at the end of the day, it's a stage manager. I mean, to be honest, it's the voice of Thornton Wilder, you know, it's the playwright. It's like, well, it's not really mystical because it's something I wrote. You know, so it was kind of coming out of my head. So I love the duality of those things.
What does the stage manager want?
The stage manager wants the audience to understand the value of being in the moment and of our place in a huge continuum, and that it's worth striving and straining away another day. It's like a very gentle rolling out of those notions over time, and also having the patience, I think, to allow the story to unfold and to entrust the other characters to try to make those points and to observe, you know, and see how that story is landing on an audience and trying to poke them a little bit, I guess.
And Brent, I'm thinking that one of the things about all of the other characters that are here is that they're archetypes, but they're also very real people, and we care about them. And I think that's another brilliance of the way this is written. We want to know what happens with Emily. We want to know what happens with Mr. and Mrs. Webb. We want to know And we do know these people.
We do. And it's the brilliance of Wilder's writing. You know, as we're working through the play, you sort of think of George and Emily as the sort of emotional core of the play. And you think, oh, they're ever present in the thing. They're there constantly. The play is 80-some pages long, and they have three scenes together for a total of 16 pages. So the way that he is able to create these huge journeys for these characters in very, very little real estate is not only an artistic accomplishment, but it allows the play to be so densely packed with human life. And for me, it's not just knowing necessarily what's going on with George and Emily or their parents, but in addition to that, knowing the inner lives of all of these other characters, these people we only meet for two or three pages each act, but have these huge resonances of their own. It's great to just sort of stand back from the play a little bit and just look at this really neat collage of humanity that appears on stage. And it sort of feels like if you sort of took the play and turned it 90 degrees, well, that becomes somebody else's story then. You know, perhaps George and Emily fade into the background and we learn so much more about how he knew the milkman, or we learn the full backstory of why Simon Stimson is leading such a difficult, fraught, woeful life. Turn it another way and it becomes a story about somebody who's maybe not even on stage in this version of the play. You know, so there's something beautifully kaleidoscopic about all the human relationships in it. And that notion of archetype is so fun too, because it's very easy to sort of take on the surface and to not really dig deeply into these people, because you have the town gossip, you have the town drunk, you have the town policeman who, you know.
The ingenues and the, you know, yeah,
exactly. But as soon as you dig under that top layer, you realize how much depth and individual life Wilder has imbued these people with in very, very few words and very little territory. So much of the play exists in the listening between two characters, in the silences between people, in what's not said, in how a nonverbal moment is filled. And that's the stuff that's not only the most delicious to explore, but that's the stuff that we're seeing now resonates the most loudly and really creates a lot of room for the audience to get into the play.
I'm sitting here with two theater people. Why do you think it's a stage manager in a play? Why do you think that character is a stage manager? Because theater people know what a stage manager mm-hmm. does. But the audience might not.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Well, I think Laura said at one point it's a stage manager because not even Thornton Wilder's pretentious enough to call it the playwright.
or God. Yeah,
yeah, exactly. Right. But there is this sense of a stage manager as a facilitator of something, right? Not necessarily a creator of it, but someone who helps a process move along. And I think as Laura was saying, you know, wanting to sort of guide the audience and wanting to make sure the audience gets it, as omniscient as the stage manager is and as much agency as the stage manager has, we don't ever really get the sense that the stage manager is manipulating, right? The stage manager exists to call our attention to things, to make sure we're hearing things. The stage manager creates space for the audience in the play. But I think we don't ever get the sense of the sort of the heavy hand of a director, say, in the character of the stage manager, mm-hmm. right? It's much more gentle than that.
More of a tour guide in
yeah,
some ways.
In a way.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
It must be wonderful to just be in the room with all of that.
Oh, yeah. No, one of the great pleasures of rehearsing the play is to hear Laura speak all these beautiful lines. And
you've got a fantastic cast, too, in addition
yeah.
to Laura.
I mean, no, it's a remarkable group of actors. And the fact that we have, I mean, true masters of the craft playing roles that have only two or three pages of stage time in the whole thing just allows the depth of the play to come out, and to see what these real lifelong craftspeople are able to create out of a few sentences is really one of the joys, I think, of this particular production.
And you're reunited, Laura, with a bunch of folks that you have been on stage with a lot in this.
It's
that must be delicious, too.
It's so good.
Yeah.
It's great.
Will you be so kind as to give us a few of those wonderful words
Absolutely.
That we've been talking about and just kind of tell us where we are?
Sure. This is a little speech in the first act, in a moment where the stage manager comes in and sort of interrupts the action and says, here's a little something that I think I need to point out to you. It goes like this. I think this is a good time to tell you that the Cartwright interests have just begun building a new bank in Grover's Corners. Had to go to Vermont for the marble, sorry to say. And they've asked a friend of mine what they should put in the cornerstone for people to dig up 1,000 years from now. Of course, they've put in a copy of the New York Times and a copy of Mr. Webb's Sentinel. We're kind of interested in this because some scientific fellas have found a way of painting all that reading matter with a glue, a silicate glue that'll make it keep 1,000, 2,000 years. We're putting in a Bible and the Constitution of the United States and a copy of William Shakespeare's plays. What do you say, folks? What do you think? You know, Babylon once had 2 million people in it, and all we know about them is the names of the kings and some copies of wheat contracts and contracts for the sale of slaves. Yet every night all those families sat down to supper, and the father came home from his work and the smoke went up the chimney, same as here. And even in Greece and Rome, all we know about the real life of the people is what we can piece together out of the joking poems and the comedies they wrote for the theater back then. So I'm going to have a copy of this play put in the cornerstone, and the people 1,000 years from now will know a few simple facts about us. More than the Treaty of Versailles and the Lindbergh flight. You see what I mean? So, people 1,000 years from now, this is the way we were in the provinces north of New York at the beginning of the 20th century. This is the way we were in our growing up and in our marrying and in our living and in our dying.
You know, you read the words and you hear it in your head, but to hear you say them, thank you.
Sure, thank
you. Wow. And I have to say, as somebody who is from New Hampshire, that joke about getting the marble from Vermont is a very real one because New Hampshire very quickly mined out its marble and granite. And so all of the marble and granite now still comes, even though New Hampshire is the granite state.
The granite state. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yep. It comes from Vermont. So 100 years later, that still rings true for anyone. I just had to point that out. Well, I want to thank you both for coming in and sharing a little bit about the play. I cannot wait to see it. Thank you so much.
Thanks,
thank you. Pleasure to be here.
Brett Hazelton is Associate Artistic Director of the Milwaukee Rep and directs the Rep's production of Our Town. Laura Gordon stars as the stage manager. The show opens tonight at the Rep's Quadracci Powerhouse Stage and runs through mid-May.
A family's life is turned upside down in a new novel written from three different perspectives. We'll meet Madison writer Rebecca Brown when Lake Effect continues in a moment on Milwaukee's NPR.
Lake Effect continues on WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Mitch Tine.
And I'm Bonnie North. How would you react if a member of your family suddenly died and then he didn't? That's the conundrum faced by members of the family at the heart of Wisconsin writer Rebecca L. Brown's new novel, Flying at Night. The book tells the story of a Madison woman named Piper, her son Fred, and her very difficult father, Lance.
It is Lance who collapses and dies suddenly and then turns out not to have died after all. But it is clear he is not the same person he was before the incident. In fact, the family is coming to terms, in some cases reluctantly, with the truth that many people are not as they once appeared. Rebecca Brown will talk about the book tomorrow evening at Boswell Book Company. But ahead of that, she is with us in the studio. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
If I understand correctly, there are a couple of real-life stories or real-life situations that inspire some of the key events in this novel. What was the first spark that set the story in motion for you?
The first piece was, about 11 years ago, we went through a diagnosis for my son of high-functioning autism spectrum disorder. And he had had problems in elementary school academically since kindergarten. Just never quite getting what he needed to get. The reading came slow. The math came slow. And by the time he got to fifth grade, we were wondering if there was a learning disability or something else going on. And so we actually took him to a pediatric neuropsychologist for a battery of tests, fully expecting that what would come back was dyslexia or a processing disorder. And what came back to us was a high-functioning autism diagnosis. And that was a huge surprise. I taught children with autism early in my teaching career, so I really felt blown away by this diagnosis because I felt like I should have seen it coming because I worked with children with autism. I knew what autism looked like, but I didn't. And once we kind of got past the shock and kind of what the next steps were, looking at his life and his personality and everything about him in totality, there were a lot of subtle signs that we just kind of wrote off as just a quirky personality. And I mean, he did have some of the typical things that you see, obsession about certain topics when he was young, like Fred in the book.
Eye contact, things like that?
Some eye contact, but I didn't notice it. That was something that the neuropsych pointed out. And when she said it, I said, no, of course that's not a problem. But the more we kind of, my husband and I stepped back and could look at everything, it made sense. Every time I talk about this, I promised him, because he's in high school now, that he said I could talk about it if I also talked about how well he's doing and that he is now almost a 4.0 student in high school and is on a team sport for the first time in his life, has friends, and was one of the first kids to have girlfriends in seventh grade. So that was exciting. So he's doing really well now. But that was the first kind of impetus for the book.
Well, and so how much of Piper's reaction? Piper in the book is the mom. Fred is the son. How much of her reaction mirrors your own? Because she was really kind of in denial for quite some time.
You know, there are parts of it that definitely came from my experience, and then there are parts that were a little bit exaggerated or embellished. One thing that was true was that he kept having trouble, and he kept having trouble, and I would notice these kind of weird little things. Like in preschool, they couldn't have fire drills on the days that he was there because the loud noise, he couldn't handle it. And I just thought, oh, well, that's really nice of them to do that. But that was actually something that was probably a cue. But I was waiting for a teacher to say, hey, this isn't quite normal, but that didn't come. And so that's the same. And when I go back now, I've talked to some of his early teachers, and they're all very surprised because they said he was incredibly high functioning even then. So some of it is the same. Yeah.
Right. And a lot of what transpires in the book is kind of this bewildering experience that they go through when they're working with both the neuropsych and the officials at school and a particular advocate. And I imagine, you know, even if we're not talking about a high functioning autism disorder, anything along those lines, this is a very familiar feeling to anyone who's kind of gone through the IEP process.
Right.
With schools.
And it is. As a parent, you want the best for your child. You want to believe that wherever they go in life, it's going to be the absolute best, most wonderful life story you can imagine. And so when you bump up against these obstacles, it rattles you because you don't know then what's going to happen next. And that was kind of one of the big things that I had to get over. And it ended up that it was silly because he's doing great. But at the time, you know, I didn't know that that was coming.
There's another key character in this story, and that is Lance,
yes.
Piper's father, Fred's grandfather. And do I understand, was there another real-life
yes.
experience that inspired Lance's story?
There was, and it's funny that you ask about that because I just had a comment from a reviewer who said this couldn't possibly happen. And it did.
Thank you, reviewer.
Yes. We have a family friend, and several years ago, he was 42 years old. He went out for a run, super health. An athlete, two small kids at home, went out for his hill run, came home, sat down on his front lawn and collapsed and had a heart attack. And we don't know how long he laid there. They were guessing it could have been up to 20 minutes. And someone found him, did CPR on him. They got his heart beating in the ambulance on the way to the hospital. But he got to the hospital and they said, you know, he's going to be a vegetable. There's nothing there. So they took him off all of the machines per his wishes and took him to hospice. And once he was off everything at hospice, we took turns visiting him. And the first day that he was there, I stood next to his bed and he opened his eyes and they said, well, you know, he'll, it's like an infant. They open their eyes. They don't know. And he looked at me and he said, do I know you? And that was kind of the first step to this, like, I still get goosebumps talking about it because it was so surreal. Everyone had said goodbye. You know, this was the end. And he's now walking, talking, New York Times, reading, driving, working, person. So it can happen. They think that because his blood was so heavily oxygenated that that kept his brain alive.
Which is the case with Lance,
right.
In fact. Hopefully, this person you know, not as difficult a character
as
Lance.
Oh, no, no, no.
Well, and so you write from three points of view. You write from Piper's point of view, Fred, and Lance. As the story opens, though, Lance's chapters are written from him as he was then known as the Silver Eagle. But after he has his medical emergency, that persona slips away, and he's just writing as Lance.
It does. One of the things, what I recognized when we went through this with our family friend and then reading and researching traumatic brain injury is that it looks different for different people. Like, there really is no norm. And some people, their personalities completely change. Some people don't. Some people become violent and mean and aggressive, and some people become softer. And so I felt like it was really wide open to kind of what the story needed. And so I really felt like in order for this family to move forward, he kind of needed to be a different person.
Right, and he is very much softer. You know, he was an abusive husband and father,
yes,
up until that point.
Yeah,
I am assuming, and maybe I should not assume, but I'm assuming that maybe Piper was the easiest of the three voices to channel.
You know, yes. And no. Hers came the most naturally because she's a mother and I'm a mother. Fred's was really fun to write. It was really fun to kind of forget about grammar and all those things that kind of keep you penned in as a writer and just write as a 10-year-old boy.
Did your son help? I mean, your son obviously was older at this point, but did he consult at all?
No, he had no interest at all in this. He did read the book when the advanced reader copy came out like 6 months ago. He read it and he said, "This is actually good." I was like, "Well, thank you." So, no, he didn't have any input at all. The part that was the hardest was Lance, and I was mostly worried because I'm not a, 70-year-old man. And so I was mostly worried about getting that right. But
well, and the impression that's hard to shake is that Lance, after his brain injury, sees the world and kind of describes it in a way very much the way Fred does.
Yes. Yes. And that that was kind of the point where I hoped that the two of them could connect. Him kind of – Lance losing all of the anger and all of those things that he carried from his past life with Fred, who as a child had a kind of more innocent worldview anyway.
Going back to Piper for a moment, for being a sympathetic heroine, she is a far from perfect character.
Yes. Someone, another reviewer described her as annoying, which I can't disagree with because I really wanted her to be intense. And a lot of people say, well, that must be you. And I said, I'm not that intense, I hope. she has strong feelings. She has strong, she's thinking all the time. Her brain is constantly going. And she makes some decisions that even I, as the writer, was kind of like, I'm not sure about that.
But she was also raised, she also grew up in a household with a really overbearing father.
She did. And I wanted to make sure there's certain points in the book where she comes kind of face to face with that, not necessarily on her own, but other people saying, hey, wait a second, look at what you're doing. And that was a surprise for her. And I think that ultimately helps her kind of get a better look at herself from other people's views.
She does not give a lot of people any breaks, including herself.
She does not. Nope. Not at all. Except Fred.
Right.
Fred gets a lot of breaks because he's her baby.
Obviously, not everyone who reads this will share the exact experiences that your characters are going through or have gone through. But what would you want to leave your readers with? What do you hope that when they put this book down, when they're done with it, aside from, writing a spectacular review, what would you hope they're left with?
Oh, wow. I hope that they kind of have a new point of view into a person that's nothing like them. There are so many things that parents of special needs, of children with special needs, go through that if you have a neurotypical child or a normally developing child, that don't ever really cross your path. And there's a lot of emotion and heart and really hard stuff that parents of children with disabilities deal with. And I hope that people will kind of have a better understanding of what that feels like. I also really hope that people will start to think about autism as a spectrum. It used to be what Fred has, or what he was diagnosed with, used to be called Asperger's. And a couple years ago, they changed the name of that. They changed the entire designation to autism spectrum disorder because they realized that it is a spectrum. There are no two people on the spectrum that look the same. Everybody looks different. And so Fred is at the high end of that spectrum. And that's something that I wanted people to recognize, that there is a wide range. And just because a child is verbal, and Fred's super in touch with people's emotions and things, but he does struggle in other areas.
Well, was it especially rewarding for you to be able to portray someone who is dealing with a whole family, honestly, but Fred in particular, in what's really, you know, a nuanced but overall positive way?
Yes, it was. You know, it's a hard road for them. It's a difficult road for them. But I feel like by the time they get to the end, Piper has kind of worked through her sadness and her regret even. And she's really ashamed that she didn't figure it out, because she feels like she knows him better than anyone. She should have seen it. She works through that guilt. And I think that everybody understands each other better. And everyone just kind of accepts that this is who this kid is, and he's amazing.
Writer is not your full-time job.
No,
You work at a preschool, right?
I do. I teach 4K in Madison, Wisconsin.
How did that work afford you any energy to write fiction?
Oh, it's hard. So when I started this book, it was like my second year teaching, and the idea was I work in the mornings, so I would come home, and I would eat lunch, and I would sit down at the computer, and I would write until my children came home from school. And some days that worked really well. Other days it did not. I found out Law and Order is on all day on Wednesdays. So Wednesdays I'd get nothing done. But I tend to write in spurts. My husband is super supportive. And if I say I really need all day Saturday to get some writing done, no problem. He's on top of, you know, the house, the kids, the dogs, and everything. And
well, Rebecca Brown, it's a terrific book. Congratulations.
Thank you.
And hope we'll see you again.
Yes, I would love to come back.
Madison writer and preschool teacher Rebecca Brown's new novel is called Flying at Night. She'll talk about it tomorrow evening at Boswell Book Company. There's a link to more at WUWM.com. And that wraps up today's edition of the show. Thanks for joining us. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Great to have you along for the ride, and I sure hope you'll be with us again tomorrow at 10 for another Lake Effect on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
Fresh Air comes your way next, so stay tuned. It's 11 o'clock.